Hello, it's Yotam here. Thank you for continuing to listen to Simple Pleasures. And for anyone new here, I hope you enjoy the series. I wanted to let you know that I have a new cookbook out this September, co-written with Easter Belfridge, who works with me in my test kitchen. It's called Ottolenghi Flavor and is available to order now. Flavor is a vegetable-scented cookbook which focuses on all the different ways in which you can dial up flavor and create fireworks in your cooking, true to the Ottolenghi spirit. Hello and welcome to Simple Pleasures with me, Yotam Ottolenghi. This is a series in which I invite you and a special guest to my home to discuss the simple pleasures in life. From food, mainly food actually, to travel, to art, to food again. We discuss all of this over dishes from my new cookbook, Ottolenghi Simple. To me, simple means ease. It means less anxiety and less stress, doing things that are comfortable and familiar and not always massively challenging. I want to take the guilt out of the equation and inject an extra dose of joy. This week's guest is a real treat. He's one of the UK's best-known comedic actors, an author, a presenter, and the nicest man in Britain. So I heard. It's Michael Palin. So what to cook for Michael? I decided on burrata and char-grilled grapes to start with, pappardelle with rose harissa, black olives and capers, and alongside some gem lettuce with fridge-raised dressing, and we finish off with sweet and salty cheesecake with cherries. So let's enjoy Simple Pleasures with Michael Palin. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Yotam. Good morning.
Thank you for coming here.
Oh, nice. It's a total pleasure.
I think it's
going to be a total pleasure.
You know, it's going to be a simple pleasure. Thank you. Those are lemons.
Yeah, lemons. Yeah, lovely.
Your work?
No, that is a work of an Argentinian friend of a friend artist, and she made it. It was in one of our restaurants for a few years, and then we had enough of it, and then I appropriated it and brought it here.
Yeah.
I read that you're the nicest man in Britain. Is
that's
that
a
true?
Slur. It's a terrible slur, Yotam. I have to live with this, you know?
I think you
I'm a great appreciator of things, put it that way.
Okay.
I'm not particularly nice, you know.
Well, really, I've watched you engage with this. So, sorry, this is Michael Palin, and there's so many titles I can give you. I'm just going to assume people would know, and then we'll talk about all the amazing things that you've done over the years. But I've watched you talk to people when you travel all over the world, and I can see why they would say that, because when you don't share a language with someone, it's very easy to get frustrated. But for you, it seems like you make the most out of it.
Well, it was a big challenge to me, because I when I was young, I didn't travel, and my reluctance to travel was partly because I felt I won't be able to deal with the language. Language is something that's going to keep us apart. When I was asked to do Around the World in 80 days, there was no way I could learn all the languages on the way round. So I just had to go for it and improvise and smile a lot and, you know, do the normal things you do when you don't know the language. And I suddenly realised that people will communicate with you. People will give back some hospitality, friendship. They want to. And they don't worry that you can't speak the language. They appreciate it if you know one word or something like that, or a phrase. But basically, they just want to talk to you. They want to get something back as well.
But it's also something wonderful for TV, these moments where you say something. Obviously, the other side doesn't understand. They say something you don't understand. And then you could just do whatever you like with it. Oh. It wouldn't work on a podcast.
No. It wouldn't be a different kind of podcast. You'd have to follow it yourself with a dictionary. It's had some wonderful moments where we've just been total cross purposes. I remember going across the Huy River, and we were in a little dhow, and I was being told to sort of start the engine, and then we talk and start the engine, and off we go. And so I said to this guy, the little Vietnamese guy, okay, so start the engine now. And he goes, yes, oh yeah. I said, no, we go across the other side of the river. He said, yeah. And he was looking at the camera all the time.
I wish people could see your face.
So I said, no, so now start the engine now. And he said, start engine now? I said, yeah, start engine now. And it was almost as though he was thought it was a comedy routine that he was applied. Eventually we got the engine started, and it was hilarious. We got across the Huy River, a very beautiful the other side were going to eat, actually. And so I said, that's fine, just stop the engine now. But stop the engine now. Stop engine now? And I said, stop the engine. So it was just a completely total sort of cross purposes. But actually, it made for a very funny sequence.
Yeah.
I became totally unafraid of making a fool of myself, which is something you have to get over when you're doing a travel series.
Well, for a comedian, it's kind of easy, right? Like,
I like people to laugh at me, I suppose. Yeah. But, you know, I like to be in control as well. But no, it was, I could see the funny side. But also, I remember in a yurt in Tibet, just with a yak herder, and we talked for about 15 minutes, neither of us understanding what the other was saying, but we were inside the yurt, his two children were there, his wife was there, sort of churning butter, and we just talked about the children. I said, there was always one, isn't there, who cries, and the other one tries to be very nice, and he says something in Tibet, and we kind of knew through the children exactly what was going on. So it was a universal situation.
Fantastic.
With those children and the wife cooking and all that sort of stuff, and him sitting around.
So I'll be the wife cooking now, and I'll I prepared some char grilled grapes with burrata.
Fantastic.
That would be our starter with
Lovely.
Some basil.
Mm.
And then some pappardelle with harissa, olives and capers. So it's a kind of like a North African pasta.
All right, okay.
Yeah. And some gem lettuce salad with what I call a refrigerated dressing, which is essentially everything you have at the bottom of your fridge blitzed together.
Good.
Avocado and ginger, dill, basil, parsley, a bunch of other things. And then
you've obviously got a lot at the bottom of your fridge.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. Well, that day there was a lot. Now it turned into a recipe, so everybody has to follow it, like, to the T. So I'll just do throw the pasta in.
Okay.
And cook that.
Where did you originally learn, Yotam? Was it sort of at your mother's knee, or you taught yourself?
A little bit at my parents' knees. So my dad, you can hear it on my surname, is Italian.
Right. Yeah.
Jewish Italian. And my mum is, her family is from Germany. So when I was growing up in Israel, it was very European food, Southern European and Northern European. But then when I walked out into the streets, you know, it was the Middle Eastern business, you know, Palestinian food, which was a completely different kind of food, you know, much less structured, much more kind of, you know, in restaurants with, just big tables full of food.
Yeah.
So I consider myself very lucky to have been exposed to quite a lot of food cultures at a very young age. And I think that affected the way I cooked it. Also, I think because I don't feel like I'm committed to one particular culture or shackled down by one tradition. You know, there was a lot there. So I kind of feel free to mix and match when I can, as long as it works. I don't know if it always works. But
well, it's a bit like going around the world and not knowing the language. You know, you're not sure if it's going to work or not, but you've got to have a go.
You've got to have a go. And once you've succeeded once or twice, you just know that it works, right? And Michael, so you traveled a lot, and we were just talking now before we started about grandchildren. When your kids were growing up, were you traveling then? So how was it not to be away from your family?
You know, it's sort of, we didn't stop and have a great debate about it when I was going to do the long journeys. It was just a lot of my work involved up to that time going away filming for 3 or 4 weeks or something like that, or sometimes a couple of months. So they were used to seeing this man disappear and always come back with something from some foreign country. We've got to find that. But they got to the stage by that time. I mean, they were at school sort of, when did I do Around the World in 80 Days? 88. Yeah, so they were in their teens anyway.
Yeah.
And they have their own world. They were doing their own thing and getting on with life and finding out about things. And suddenly I was gone. And we didn't make a great big thing about it. And that was the way I preferred it. I did miss them, but they dealt with it very well. My wife is extremely
supportive.
She's supportive, but also sort of very, she can look after the house extremely well. Probably looks after it better when I'm not there than when I'm there.
When you're not making
she's
a
got
mess.
This, yeah, she's got this system. And my eldest son, it was wonderful, when we were doing Full Circle, I think. He arrived fairly soon after I'd gone, and he said, where's Dad? And my wife said, he's gone, he's doing a series around the Pacific. How long have you gone for? Well, it could be a sort of three or four months. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I need some money. And it was just... It was very nice, the way they do it. They weren't sort of, oh, Daddy, you've gone. And the same way when I came back, it wasn't really what people think. I, you know, sit around the table and hear all the stories of where you've been, travellers' tales. I thought it would be that, but it wasn't. They were not there. And my wife had gone out to badminton that night or something like that.
And
you can't sort of expect to come back and tell them all about everywhere you've been, because you know that's sort of you have to give about I think several days before you really start talking about it, because you forget their life has gone on. They've had their own crises, problems. You know, teenager. They've got far more things to talk about. Well, they won't talk about to you, but far more things have happened to them probably in the short time than happened to me, just because I've been to this country or that country. Isn't one thing or the other.
Yeah, I have the same when I travel on book tours, which I'm sure you do too. I come back and you're kind of on that. I come from, you know, being a few weeks. I never go for more than 3 weeks away, and we've got very little children. So as soon as I arrived, I walk into the door, and Carl, my husband, he hands me over our little son, Flynn, who is still in his nappies, and goes, go change a nappy before we talk about anything else. Yeah.
I'm afraid there is that, yes. Now you're going to pay for that nice time abroad. And whatever you say about, oh, it was awful, you know, we cut across the desert and there was no food and the vehicles were falling apart and, you know, broke my leg and all that. And, oh, come on, don't pretend you didn't have a good time.
Yeah.
Very hard to persuade. I get that too. Very hard to persuade one's family that going abroad is anything other than a cushy job. Which of course it is, right? Yeah, you know.
Even when you do book signings, you still go to a hotel room with no responsibilities and you don't need to look after anyone else but yourself, and it's all very, very comfortable. But did you ever feel, and I shouldn't probably be asking that, but do you ever feel that you have, that it was just too much, too hard, too extreme, like, you know, being away for months and months and being in those particular conditions that are possibly challenging, or you? Mm. I saw you on a hammock, sleeping the whole night on a hammock in Brazil, and that seemed like I wouldn't sleep for a second.
Really? It's great.
You slept the whole night?
Have you never slept in a hammock?
I fall asleep on a hammock for like half an hour, but then I would go to bed.
Well, it was either, you were either hammock class, which is absolutely jammed together, or downstairs where there were no hammocks or anything. It was blazingly hot.
So hammock class
was the comfortable bit.
Okay.
So we were in the hammocks all day long. That wasn't particularly painful. I think sometimes...
What other painful things happened to you?
I mean, you would have dietary problems. I remember being in...
Oh, I was going to talk to you about food, actually.
I don't want to put us off our lunch.
No, you can. Let's get all this out of the way and then
we can eat. Well, I'll just say that, as you know, food is one of those things that signifies hospitality. It's one of the great things that brings you together, but you don't speak the language. Food and comedy.
And
children, actually. That's four things.
Four.
But a lot of people say, why do you eat that food? You know, that strange foreign food. And I said, well, come on, that's not strange to them. That's what they eat in their country. I can't go there and bring out a sort of Marks and Spencer's pork pie or something like that and start eating
which
that.
Which would be very disgusting to them, right?
It would be very disgusting to them. We did actually...
I've never got the cold pork pie until after only having living here for a long time. Yeah. I got the whole day deal.
No, there are other things.
The jellied cold thing that is just weird.
Well, you don't need it.
No.
You have many other alternatives. But I do remember when we did Around the World in 80 Days and we were kind of making up our own rules, I don't think of anything like that where you're going to be away for as long as it took to get round the world with the crew. And the crew changed in Hong Kong, but basically you're working with people a lot of the time. And our sound man particularly was very, very nervous of foreign food. And he opened a tin. We were on this dhow, and it was really just a lot of fishermen from Gujarat in northern India. There weren't people with much money. They were pretty poor. Yet our sound man decided he wouldn't, you know, we should not eat their food, which is probably a good thing, as they didn't have much. But we should eat our own. And I remember him opening a tin of Sainsbury's tuna, and you saw it slide from the tin, and it went plonk onto the plate, and it sort of lay there, quivering slightly, shining, you know. And anything less, you wanted to eat less than that at that time. And anyway, after that, they kept asking us, do you want us to make you some food? And in the end, they... made their meagre rations go round and help us out. And they made curries for us, and we gave them some bath. Far superior, absolutely fantastic. So, I mean, I've always eaten the local food, but sometimes it does have problems. In we were going on the Sahara journey. We went to see to a refugee camp in Algeria. And they looked after us, again, extremely well. And they'd got a camel, some camel meat, which they had bought on the Monday. We were staying with them for 4 or 5 days. Very expensive, but they insisted that we must have meat at every meal. And on the very last day when we were leaving, she said, you know, oh, you must just have the last of the camel meat is for you, Michael. And I took it, and as I put it in my mouth, I knew that this camel meat was past its sell-by date. Oh. Well past. Yes, but I'd eaten it by then. And she was smiling at me and looking like that, and I couldn't really sort of go, take it out, don't give me this. But I suffered.
You suffered.
I suffered
after
for
this.
2 days, yeah. But you had to keep working. We were doing an interview with a leader of the Free Polisario movement.
Oh, yeah.
And I would go in and ask him a few questions and then apologise, go out, throw up, come back and ask him a few more questions. He didn't seem to notice particularly. He was just kind of more interested in the politics
that
of the region.
To him all the time.
Yeah, but he does. Perhaps he thought as my reaction to his talking about politics. It's obviously making this man sick. But, I mean, I've never really regretted ever eating the local food when I can. But you've got to be a bit careful, and your own stomach is sort of conditioned against
it. And after a while, things that you would probably be put off by or a bit disgusted by just seem completely natural because you've seen everything and eaten everything.
And, I mean, people, I find in places where they have fewer ingredients, very often people make the most of them very cleverly and very skillfully. They use a few things but mix them together terribly well, whereas we think we've got to have a big meal and it's got to have the meat there and the vegetables there and they've all got to have their own.
And it's kind of almost your job to eat because that's how... I mean, because if you don't have the language, and you said food is the common language, if you decide not to eat, you kind of already break a little bit of the rules of engagement with as a visitor. You know, it's not your job to reject food, right?
But it's never been a problem for me. I don't want to reject food. I've learned most of the meals I've had have been fantastic. And, you know, in Africa, you end up having goat almost wherever you go. It's the main meat. So there's no point saying I don't eat goat or anything like that. It's really nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I should have made goat for you next time.
Well, I had the freshest goat ever because we went to a restaurant, very sort of dark night on Lake Tanganyika, and we went into somewhere, so you must go to this restaurant, it's very good. Total darkness, but as we went in, there was a little goat sort of by the door, so a little pen going, yeah, and we all, lovely, oh, isn't it beautiful? And we went in later. Said, what's on the menu? Well, tonight, goat's the thing. And he said, oh, well, that's lovely. Yes, you've got some goat stew. And we just heard this little goat by the door going one last. Said, yeah. And that was it. So it was fresh goat. And we had to say, gosh, this really is fresh. So there again, you get away from the processing of food, which is all done elsewhere and all packaged up and give a sell by date. You get away from all that. It's just you are eating the food that is in the yard. Yeah. Or in the field next door.
And
I quite like that.
And that is part of the story, right?
Yeah, you learn a little about how people live. They look good. That looks very good, that pasta.
That's the pappardelle.
Yeah.
And that's the sauce. I'm just going to literally put them together. And then we can go and have a little sit down.
But it's great to be in your kitchen talking about all the problems I've had with bad camel and all that. And
There's no meat in this meal for no apparent reason. But like I said, it's a kind of North Africa meets Italy. But actually, you know, that connection between North Africa and Southern Europe has been going on for centuries.
When
you go to Sicily or when you go to Southern Italy, you see those connections all the time. So chilies, capers, olives, you can find them both in Southern Italy and in North Africa. Shall we move to the table? Shall we go and sit down?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
That is nice. Yeah.
This is as simple as it gets. It's just some char-grilled grapes with sherry vinegar and fennel seeds and burrata.
Wow, it looks terrific, especially the burrata. So,
so tell me about the latest project, the ship.
Well, I was asked to give a talk at the London Club about one of the members of the club. The idea was a member alive or dead that interested you, and you talked about it for an hour. And I had just been to Brazil doing a series there. And one of the things that came up was this idea of sort of imperial sort of botanical piracy in the 19th century, so that Kew Gardens particularly used to try and get seeds from all over the world of various exotic plants and trees which they could grow in the British colonies.
Wow.
And one of the great successes was getting rubber seeds from Brazil. Rubber was the biggest industry for them. And an Englishman smuggled out these seeds. They went to Kew, a man called Joseph Hooker, who happened to be the director of Kew at that time, germinated them, and they were sent out to Malaya or wherever the British possessions were in the East. And it created a huge industry and decimated the
Brazilian
industry. So that just disappeared within about 20 years. So I thought it was an outrageous act, really. But there was this one guy who'd smuggled them out. He'd obviously sort of put them in and got them under some sort of papers and sent them off on the ship. And
it's the equivalent of industrial espionage of the 21st century.
Yeah, yes,
but once it's out, it's out. There's nothing you could do about it because they can just grow it.
And actually,
in other colonies.
It turned out they grew better in the colonies because they had no natural predators, the rubber trees. And they could do it on an industrial scale, whereas in Brazil, it was still a lot of rubber tappers working away. But anyway, this man Hooker interested me, this guy who'd organized it all, and was called Sir Joseph Hooker, very honored and all that. And it turned out at the age of 22, he'd gone on a ship to Antarctica, a sailing ship, in 1839. And he'd signed on as sort of assistant surgeon and botanist. So he got this job. And it was aboard a ship called Erebus, about 104 feet long, 60 men aboard. And they went on this extraordinary journey to Antarctica. They got further south than any other ship had ever been. They surveyed all the islands around Antarctica. They circumnavigated the continent. They were there for 4 years before they got back home.
Wow.
And nobody's ever heard of this. I'd never heard of that. You know, you'd heard Drake and Cook and that sort of thing. But I'd never heard of this particular expedition. So the ship was called the Erebus. And I wonder what happened to it later. And later, just a few years after it got back, it was chosen to go to the Northwest Passage with a man called Sir John Franklin. They're going to try and get the route through from the Atlantic to the Pacific once and for all. Total disaster. All men lost. The ships disappeared. No one knew what happened to them. They gradually, over the years, pieced together the truth, which was that they perished of starvation in the ice. And the Erebus was the ship that had carried them there. Then, 4 years ago, and this is what really sort of made me say I've got to do this, the hull of the Erebus was discovered underneath the Arctic Ocean in northern Canada by some Canadian archaeologists. So the ship still exists. It's still there under the water with secrets yet to be uncovered.
Wow, so they were actually seeking it actively or they just bumped?
No, they were seeking it actively.
So they knew the story and they were looking for the Erebus.
It was a huge story for the Canadians. They kind of took over the whole story because it all happened on their territory in the far north. And it was one of the only things that really happened over the years, the search for the Northwest Passage. And so they were the ones who were looking for these ships. And, so then I thought,
I'll let you eat something before I ask you more questions because it's impossible to eat and talk at the same time.
So
this is the problem with this podcast.
Gorgeous.
Did you like this?
Very much. I like the grapes. So the grapes are just...
The grapes are just normal grapes that are... red grapes that are tossed in olive oil and grilled. But what I think is really nice is the grapes with the fennel seeds, because they sit around with the fennel seeds for a little while and just absorb those flavors. It's a tiny bit of sugar and some vinegar.
It's all about what you sort of marinating and putting things together that would perhaps not normally be put together.
Because
so a grape becomes a recipient of other tastes rather than just purely a grape.
Precisely. And one of the things that I opened a restaurant called Nopi 6 years ago in the West End. We started serving burrata with white peaches and fennel seeds. So this is a kind of a take on that. And people were was saying, you know, that is sacrilegious because in Italy you only serve burrata with tomatoes, with nothing else. But after a while, I started looking around and I realized also in Italy people use burrata in more creative ways than people tend to think. Mm. So it's not just a combination of, you know, basil and burrata. It's such a great thing. Do you cook?
I don't cook, no. No, I don't really.
You never
cook? I'm sure I can, but I don't. My wife's a very good cook.
What does
she's
she,
always
what
done
does
the
she
cooking.
Cook?
Well, mainly sort of she's English standards, really.
Yeah.
Pies and cottage pies and nice stews and things like
that. Yeah, they're delicious, aren't they? When they're done properly.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Carl, my partner, he does a lot of, you know, pies for the children and casseroles and stews And I think they prefer it to the food I make for them because it's much more familiar and easy to. It's not as challenging.
You know, they call it comfort food, but it's not. That's not a bad. Yeah, that tends to be a rather.
Comfort, I think, is very cultural relative.
But I think it's a nice thing that food makes you feel comfortable as you eat it.
Yes,
and reassuring.
Let me take this plate.
Delicious. That was delicious. The burrata is just absolutely sensational.
It's so good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe you can make that.
Yes, well, like, take me in hand, as they say.
So this is the parpadelli with the harissa and tomatoes, and it really is kind of a hybrid.
It's lovely, yes, nice thick pasta.
Yeah, you like pasta.
Yeah, I like pasta.
I'm going to give you the salad afterwards.
Okay.
In a truly Italian fashion, we don't mix... This is something that
that's
my dad told me.
Very good.
Don't mix things on the plate.
Mm-mm. I was recently in North Korea. And
I wanted to ask you about North
cold
Korea.
Noodles. It's a big
cold
thing.
Noodles.
Cold noodles. Big sort of brown.
Are they from wheat or from buckwheat?
I think they're made from buckwheat.
Because if they're brown, often they're made out of buckwheat.
Mm. Yeah.
And
they're eaten in enormous amount. You get a great big dish. And I thought, you know, I'm on camera and I'm eating this and I'm slurping away. And I look around, everybody else in the restaurant was also kind of just shoveling it
so
in.
So you just did it.
There's no tidy way of doing it.
No. Could you tell me how you were allowed to go there, to North Korea?
There are tours that go in to North Korea. Westerners can go there.
With cameras? With the, TV cameras?
No, crews? Not with TV crews. But on the other hand, the company, it was basically ITN and Channel 5 who cooked up this idea of me getting in there and filming the way I film in other places, just getting a sort of portrait of the people who live there. And it just is really, really difficult to get permission for a film crew. If you're associated with BBC, ITN or anything like that, forget it. It's got to have a sort of small company that doesn't associate itself with the Western government because they're very suspicious of anybody going in there. If you can win the trust, and there was a man called Nick Bonner, who helped us get in. He'd been working with the North Koreans for about 15 years, taking people in. And he said, I know where to go to get the permissions, and I think we can do it. And eventually, it just suddenly worked. And they said, on this day, we'll be able to go, and we can take cameras in. You will be supervised, put it that way, as we were.
Yeah.
I expected that. I feel very much about travel that a lot of it is trying to overcome prejudices which exist for no particular reason, usually political, ideological. You can't go there because they're communist, because they're sort of capitalist, socialist, Muslim, whatever, you know. That shouldn't restrict you at all. I really believe the most important thing is to go there. And I mean, I can remember when, under apartheid in South Africa, a very difficult decision once I was going through South Africa to get somewhere else. Should I go there? Should I not go there? And I'm really glad that in the end I decided I went, spent a couple of days there on my way, and I had a little brief glimpse of what apartheid was really like. So I could see parks where it said no coloureds. I could see stations where there was an exit for blacks, an exit for whites. And I've never forgotten that. That's absolutely riveted on my mind. And if I hadn't gone, I'd sat back and said, oh, we shouldn't go there, we shouldn't do this. I don't think I'd have seen that on the ground as it worked, how it affected the people.
And then the viewers wouldn't have seen that because obviously they wouldn't travel there and wouldn't see. But with North Korea, sorry, I'm going to turn it very...
This is delicious, by the way. Absolutely.
Oh, thank
fantastically
you.
Fantastically delicious and wonderful.
very mundane again.
I told you I was appreciated.
I know.
It's not to be invited again.
It's not camel, it's not goat. So I thought, you know, like, I'll leave that to your travel shows. But about North Korea, so you ate these soba noodles in a big place. What else did you eat in North Korea?
The kimchi, pickled cabbage.
You like kimchi?
With chili. I did actually, yes. When I went to South Korea a long time ago, 1996, I didn't particularly like it. But going to North Korea, it's such a staple there. You've got to kind of eat it. They serve it with everything. And actually, it's very nice. It's very sort of, it's quite sharp. It's quite strong. But I found it didn't affect my digestive system. In fact, actually, I felt...
It's a great condiment to many things. So I think it works really well with starchy things, like, you know, like rice or noodles. But it's also really good with meat. So because every culture has this something that you put on the side that just kind of emphasizes the food. I mean, in our culture, it's mostly salt and pepper. But, you know, when you go places, when you've got their fish sauce and they've got or in Morocco, you've got cumin. Or, you know, so you've got these things that are the condiments of the culture. And I think kimchi just makes complete sense in that context, isn't it?
It's a Korean national dish. It seems to work. It's never the same. I found that always kind of the thicker kimchis, there were sort of slightly more sort of fluid kimchis or whatever you like, but I found it got on very well with them.
And you learn to enjoy them with time. It's like I had that problem.
I did. The great thing is about traveling and tasting and enjoying things, it's pretty much endless. You can never finish or come to an end or say you've done it all. Just you've got to be doing it all your life, really. I suppose you can say, well, I've come to an end of, as I have really, of doing the long travel series. But that's a judgment based on the way television is made and the fact one's done that and lots of other people are doing it at the moment. But in terms of travelling, anywhere, you know, even just in this country, there are lots of places I've not been to. And it really appeals to me because local areas produce not just local culture, whether it's some sort of the way they look, the way they talk, the way they paint, the design. It's as you know, in the food and the what they drink and all that. I find that absolutely fascinating, the differences. I really do.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. I've done a bit of traveling around the world, and everywhere I go, I find I had moments like you had, you know, where you come to meet someone who knows how to do something and you really want to learn, but you have no idea how to communicate. And I had that when I went to try and learn how to make proper couscous with Berbers in the mountains in Morocco. Oh, yeah. And I was sitting there with this bunch of women and they were literally, you know, we had no language in common and we were making couscous and they were just all of a sudden started laughing, you know, really hysterically. And I didn't understand what I did funny or wrong. And then someone explained to me, she said she's never seen a man roll couscous in her life. She thought that was just the most hilarious thing that has ever occurred to her. And so those are really, I guess those are really special moments. But I found your shows very generous. You know, things unfold. It doesn't feel like anyone rushes anyone anywhere. Do you feel like that kind of generosity is... are you still allowed to do it in that particular way? Or if you compare your shows from, let's say, the late 80s, early 90s to the shows you're making in the 2000s, have they kind of paced things up a bit? Or
it's a good question because I think subtly things have changed. I don't know if it's just because I'm older now and looking back, but television has to deliver much more now. There's more of a science of what people want, what they need. They've done the surveys. And really, if I was to do my journeys now, I would probably have to start off by giving whoever was employing me an account of what I was going to do. This is what they are. This is what happens now. What are you going to do? Where are you going to go? How are you going to do it?
We never
had to do that. We were trusted. After Around the World in 80 Days, Pole to Pole was just, once someone had sold the idea...
That was it. You could just
the BBC, well, we trust you and your team to make it. And the team was basically two directors and a crew of about five people. So there was maybe eight people who were making the whole thing and then the editors, maybe two more. So a dozen people making the whole series. And it gave us an extraordinary amount of freedom. And I think that we wouldn't be allowed that freedom now.
Yeah.
But then it was a very experimental way of travelling. You had reporters who, like Alan Wicker, and James Cameron, who were brilliant reporters. And then you had people like David Attenborough who were doing this sort of going abroad for sort of more scientific reasons. And in the middle, there was no, the ordinary person going abroad. That didn't happen, really. You had to have a speciality which took you abroad. And so just someone who happened to be interested in travelling could be allowed to go and do eight programmes or whatever it was extraordinary.
I was able to do that.
And I think probably what you're saying is that was why they felt loose and comfortable. We were supposed to do six episodes for Around the World in 80 Days. That was what the BBC had put up on their wall. They had made space for those six programmes in the schedule. And one of the programmes, we went on a dhow from Dubai to Bombay, as it was then. And it was a slow trip, and it took about 7 days, and it wasn't even the dhow we were supposed to be on. It was quite awkward. Communication was difficult. And in no way could we hurry. We had to go at their pace. And the editor looked at all this, and on paper, that was supposed to be about 5 or 6 minutes of the journey. And then on to Bombay, India, and off to Hong Kong, blah, blah, blah. And the editor said, I think this could be a little bit longer because it's quite nice. There's quite nice pacing on this dhow. Can you give me a few days and I'll come back to you? I said, all right. And the end of the week, went back to him and he said, yes, I think I've got it to the right length. And we said, what's that? And he said, it's about 55 minutes. And it was a brilliant stroke by the editor because actually you needed to play the pauses. You didn't want to be worried about going too quickly from place to place or people being bored. And it became one of the episodes that defined the series. Most people loved that episode because it was basically day in, day out, you're going across the Persian Gulf, but you're gradually learning how to communicate with the people on board the ship. You're making friends. And when at the very end, when I go off the ship, there's old Kasim, who was the oldest man on board, and he just suddenly hugged me as I left the dhow. And that was just because we'd been together for so long, and it was a lovely moment.
And that is fantastic, because, like you say, that is... But I think that's probably why they took you, because, you said you didn't have a speciality, so you were not a scientist and all that, but you could just board these relationships.
Well, it was a terrifying brief to do, I tell you. I thought what a wonderful thing to do, and on day one, when I actually had to get up and go, I thought, how do I do this, It's all ad-libbed. I mean, what are we going to do? What are we going to see? There's no script or anything like that, just me bungling through the world. But it worked. More bungling,
really
better.
Worked. Cheers.
Cheers, yeah. Thank you.
I'll give you some salad. Your children, did you ever take them when you were filming or not really? Traveling?
No. I mean, it was definitely a no family
and now you
business-like trip. And we did go, we used to travel quite a lot when the children were young. We go to Africa and the Seychelles and we were very lucky.
And now you have grandchildren.
Mm.
What ages are they?
12, 8, 2.5, and about 3 months.
Oh, well, there's a real
just
recent
wonderful.
Arrival.
Yeah. And with my children, they like to travel. I don't think I've ever persuaded them to, do the kind of travelling I've done. They tend to want to go to New York or somewhere like that that they know.
Ah, they don't go to exotic places?
No, not really. Although my daughter, who's she goes to India quite a lot, and she's trained in yoga and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The others, they choose, they make their own journeys. They go to a city or something for a weekend, which is what my wife and I do now. We don't go on long...
And
your
granddaughter, the 12-year-old, does she watch your show?
No,
your grandson.
Grandson is 12 years old.
Does he? Because he's in the age now that he could watch your travel show. Has he watched those?
I'm ashamed to say he hasn't really. No.
He's just got.
Not yet. I think that's the problem of having a dad who's been well known over many years, whether it was Monty Python or whatever, and all that sort of thing. The children actually look for something else. They look for their own thing.
Yeah.
I think that's partly because at school, it must be very difficult for them. They're known as having a famous father. So it can easily be picked on. Well, you got that good mark because you're dad so-and-so, and the teacher loves him or something like that.
And it's also the case that they want to carve their own. Okay, it's very difficult to be overshadowed, to think you might be overshadowed. And
exactly. And... No, I think that's true. And I think my middle son could have been a very good comedy writer. He's very good. He does very funny speeches and all that sort of thing. He's got a very good take on life. And he obviously didn't really particularly want to do it because I was doing it. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, actually, talking about fathers and sons. So, because I read you said that your dad was not that happy about your career choice, at least at the beginning.
No.
And since I had this echoes with where my dad reacted to when I decided to be a chef, I thought, like, was he actively engaged in this or you just knew he wasn't that happy with your career choice?
He was always a very cautious man. And I think now that he, like my mother really, had been... What had their life been like the first... He was 43 when I was born.
Oh.
And during those 40 years, he'd been through two world wars, a major depression. And so when I was growing up, all he just wanted to do was not rock the boat, keep things steady. Let's just kind of calm things down. And so... He was very conservative, I suppose, in that way. I wanted to sort of hang on to the old ways.
He wanted to make sure that you were safe, kind of in your choices.
Yes, but also on the limited amount of money that he had, that I could get a decent education. And that was always, I think, must have been in the back of his mind, because he paid me to go to a private school or public school. And I now know that was about sort of a third of his entire yearly income just to get me there. So wow. There's things going on. So he didn't want me to blow it by doing anything frivolous like acting, which my sister wanted to do. that was the road to ruin.
So what did he say to you?
Well, he didn't really say it. Just I was discouraged from doing any acting while I was at school. Very definitely. I've made that clear that I was there to work and acting was something you could do in the holidays, but that was all.
And was there a point where he kind of...
put his foot down?
No, later on when he acknowledged that perhaps you made the right choice after all.
Well, my poor dad, he got Parkinson's fairly early on, not early on, but when he was in his 70s. I mean, when Monty Python came along, I think he was just... utterly bewildered by the whole thing. He just didn't watch it. I didn't think he really knew quite what was happening at all. Whereas my mother was much more open to it, which was the other way around. Usually, it was men who liked it, women didn't.
Yeah, it's a men's comedy, isn't it?
Like, yeah.
Generally speaking.
So I think I never knew quite what he thought about it. He was just greatly relieved that I was in something that was popular and making enough money.
You can make a living.
Yeah, make a living. Exactly that. That's what it was all about.
Because my dad also, when I decided to study, I went to university, and then when I graduated, I chose not to carry on with my academic career.
What was that? What were you?
I studied literature and philosophy at the university in Tel Aviv, and I finished my second degree. And it was in the mid-90s, and I just decided, I said to my parents, I'm going to take a year off, and I'm going to learn how to cook properly. And my dad was just distraught. I mean, he was a very gentle, kind person, so he just, he sent me a letter, and he said, you do what you need to do, but, I don't know that that is necessarily the right thing to do after spending all these years at university.
Oh, really? Oh.
But when I turned 40... I had a big birthday and there was a lot of people around a big table and my dad was the last to speak. So each one sort of said something about me. And my dad said to me, the one thing I wish for you is that you never listen to me again.
Oh, really? Yes. Well, that's very nice. Well, that's a nice resolution. Never really had that resolution with my dad, sadly. My mother, who is a keen churchgoer, became a wonderful apologist for everything because she was living in a small village in Suffolk. When The Life of Brian came along, it was like she was almost about to be sort of, people in shops would say, that's your son's been in that terrible film that's about Jesus and all that. She said, not terrible at all. And I told her, I primed her, I said, look, it's not an assault on people who have a faith or people who believe in Jesus, it's about the appropriation of religion by authority, by hierarchies and all that sort of thing. And she sort of got that.
She got that.
I heard her once in a shop saying, "This is not about Jesus at all. It's about people who appropriate religion from to use as some means of political control." Of, maybe it's all right, Mrs. Payne. Yeah,
it's the opposite of hearing your
newspaper.
Your children quoting you. It's hearing your parents quoting
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, that's right. But I put them through it. So what's in the salad?
There's the salad dressing.
Dressing is...
This salad is really all about the dressing because I like the gem lettuce because it's hard and crunchy. And, and the dressing is really, it's just...
You can get your teeth into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Other lettuce sort of flaps about.
Exactly. I like those hearts.
Sticks to the roof of your mouth.
Exactly. Mm. And so it's got avocado and lemon juice and a few herbs and ginger, garlic. So everything put together in bits. And it just, I think it just goes really well. Often people ask me, "Well, what should I serve with your food, with your dish that's in my one of my books?" And I say, really just a salad because it's got so much already there, or salad or rice or, you know, a starch.
Yeah.
You don't need that much apart from that.
And that's what I appreciate about cooking nowadays is that I suppose when I was younger, it's all about filling you up, you know?
Yeah.
This meal's got to fill you up. And so you did eat a lot of suet and a lot of heavy pastry and a lot of potatoes and all that. And that was the aim, to keep you alive.
yeah, just to make sure you wouldn't get up in the morning.
Whereas sort of my parents never, my mother who cooked, never would have mixed all these things together, really, the way you do. And they're all there. It's just
exactly. Just, nothing here is...
There's no one thing. I mean, I don't feel at the moment, having had a delicious meal, that I'm tall, over full or anything like that. It's just I've had those tastes in my mouth, which are very, very pleasant, but, you know, I'm not sort of... Yeah. Stuffed, as we used to say at school. Yeah.
I'm going to serve us dessert.
Yeah. Oh, great.
It's a kind of a deconstructed cheesecake that essentially it's cream cheese and some feta whipped up together and cherries, fresh cherries that were just macerated and cooked with a bit of syrup and a hazelnut crumble that goes on top and really just kind of something sweet to end that bar. Lovely afternoon.
And it's nice. It doesn't look like a cheesecake. It doesn't. Not something you have to slice. It's all there, all the elements, and they look rather.
This is the one thing that I've learned from the British, to do all those kind of, you know, not deconstructed, just not constructed desserts.
Yes.
You know, things that you throw up in a bowl, like a mess or
eaten mess, all that stuff.
Or a trifle, or things that are just literally just placed in a bowl. So you don't need to work. The French would make it. Hold with gelatin to, you know.
Yes.
So if you throw a stone at it, it will still stay, you know,
have
in
a
shape.
Swan's head sticking out. And,
But the British way of doing things that are just beautifully layered and have got all sorts of flavors, I thought this is definitely kind of inspired by that.
And that's very, if I could say, a very friendly looking dish. You know, kind of, I like looking at that. And it's sort of, there's some dishes which sometimes are quite cool, rather intimidating. None of the ones you've given me today.
Thank you.
They've always been very friendly. It made me feel comfortable
So it was a friendly end to a friendly conversation.
Yeah, it was terrific. No, I'm great privilege to be cooked for like that. And I wish all my lunches could be that way. I'm a great one for lunches, actually. I think it's a...
Yeah, because we don't take enough time at lunchtime.
No. We all feel lunch is the one we can avoid and we eat in the evening, and yet... A good lunch, which we all know from holidays, is wonderful because then you have the afternoon to recover, go to sleep, read a book.
What you can
around,
do now?
Swim. I'm going to read a book, actually. I have a book I have to read by the end of next week.
Thank you for coming to my house. It was a wonderful pleasure.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you. And I thought I'd seen everywhere in the world.
And all the beautiful stories.
Thank you. And yours too. Great.
My thanks to Michael, and thank you for listening. The Simple Pleasures podcast is sponsored by my new cookbook, Ottolenghi Simple, which is available at all good bookshops. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Until then, from me, Yotam Ottolenghi, goodbye.